Thank you. This is Larry Levitt from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Welcome to this web briefing about the upcoming open enrollment period under the Affordable Care Act, which begins in less than a week. ACA marketplace consumers will find quite a bit of upheaval as they start to shop the plans during this open enrollment period. Some insurers are exiting the market, leaving fewer choices for consumers, especially in rural areas. Still, most consumers will have a choice of insurers as this open enrollment period begins. And as expected, premiums are spiking in many states in response to the fact that a larger number of sick people than expected signed up for coverage once discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions was prohibited. This open enrollment period could be pivotal for the future of the marketplaces. If enrollment continues to grow, as it did this year, many of the current concerns are likely to fade. In fact, the flip side of the big premium increases is that more insurers will likely be earning a profit on the marketplaces and be more enthusiastic about continuing to participate. One big area of uncertainty is how consumers will react to these big premium increases. Over 8 in 10 marketplace enrollees are receiving premium subsidies that rise with premiums and cushion the impact. But there are over a million people buying in the marketplaces who are not receiving subsidies, and millions of others buying directly from insurers who are part of the same insurance risk pool. They will feel the brunt of big premium increases, and some, particularly healthy people, may decide to drop coverage. While the ACA is a federal law, how it's working out has varied tremendously from state to state. Many states have not expanded Medicaid under the law, and while benchmark premiums are increasing rapidly in some states, they're actually decreasing in others. There are really 50 different Obamacares playing out in the states. To discuss these issues, we're joined by a terrific panel of KFF experts. Rachel Garfield is a senior researcher and associate director of KFF's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Cynthia Cox is associate director of the Program for the Study of Health Reform and Private Insurance at Kaiser. And Karen Pollitz is a senior fellow at KFF and a longtime expert on consumers and health insurance. We're going to start with brief presentations followed by questions from the audience. During the live discussion, submit written questions in the chat window, and we'll get to as many of them as we can. We're going to start with Rachel, who will discuss how the number of uninsured has changed under the ACA and who the remaining uninsured are as open enrollment begins.
Thanks so much, Larry. So I want to start today by setting the context for where we are going into open enrollment so that everyone understands the status of coverage today. Since the implementation of the major coverage provisions of the ACA in 2014, the uninsured rate has dropped dramatically from more than 16%, where it hovered for years and years, in fact decades, to 10%, which is the lowest rate ever recorded. And this translates to approximately 20 million people gaining coverage since 2013 off a base of more than 40 million. That said, many people do remain without insurance coverage today, and as we have in the past, we estimated eligibility for coverage for this population. Of the 27 million or so people who remain uninsured in the U.S., we estimate that more than 4 in 10, that's 43%, are eligible for some kind of financial help for coverage under the ACA. This includes 14%, or about 3.8 million people who are likely eligible for Medicaid or other public coverage as adults, 10%, or about 2.6 million people who are eligible for Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program as children, and about 19%, or 5.3 million people who are eligible for tax credits to purchase coverage through one of the marketplaces. And all of these people are eligible for either subsidized or, in the case of Medicaid, free health insurance coverage. That said, that still leaves about half of the remaining uninsured population, or a little more than half, ineligible for assistance under the law for a variety of reasons. Some people are ineligible because their income is above the level at which tax credits for marketplace coverage phase out. That's four times the poverty level, and we estimate that that's about 3 million people. Some people are ineligible because they hold an offer of coverage from their employer. We estimate that that's about 4.5 million people. Under the law, you are only eligible for tax credits in the marketplace if you don't have an offer of affordable coverage. And while we're not able to directly assess whether these offers would be considered affordable, the conservative estimate is that they are. That leaves about 5.4 million people who we estimate are ineligible because of their citizenship status. Under the ACA, and in fact, as was the case before the law, people who are undocumented immigrants are not eligible for Medicaid coverage, And they are also barred from purchasing coverage through the marketplace, even if they wanted to purchase unsubsidized coverage. Last, we estimate that about 10% of the remaining uninsured population, or 2.6 million people, fall into what is called the coverage gap. These are people who would have been eligible for Medicaid had their state opted to expand, but since their state did not expand their program under the ACA, remain ineligible for Medicaid. Their incomes, which are below the poverty level, place them below the level at which tax credits for marketplace coverage start, and so they are left without an affordable coverage option. Now, the patterns of eligibility for ACA coverage really vary widely by state. And in the report that accompanies this analysis, we actually provide state-by-state estimates. So if you're interested in understanding what's happening in your state or a particular state, I would encourage you to go look at that report. The differences are particularly stark when you're comparing states that have and have not expanded their Medicaid program. So as you can see in this figure, while in states that did expand Medicaid, 35% of the non-elderly uninsured population is eligible for Medicaid, in states that did not, that's just 13%. Interestingly, in states that did not expand their Medicaid programs, a larger share of the uninsured falls into the coverage gap than is eligible for Medicaid under those pre-ACA pathways. Now, there are other state factors that affect eligibility for coverage, such as premiums in the marketplace and underlying demographic factors like poverty and access to employer coverage. So again, if you're interested in understanding what's happening in a particular state, we do have that data available on our website. I wanted to wrap up my brief presentation by just providing some data to answer the first question I think that comes to many people's mind, which is why is it that there are so many people who are eligible for assistance under the ACA and have not enrolled in this coverage? And what we have found in some work we've done is that really it's the cost, or at least the perception of cost, that people are telling us is the main reason why they remain without coverage. Here I'm presenting some data from a project we've done where we've been following uninsured people in California over time. This data really mirrors data that we've collected from other sources, including national surveys as well, but I wanted to provide it because it's the most recent data we have available. And you can see that the leading reason why people who are uninsured tell us that they don't have coverage is that they can't afford it. Notably, very few people tell us that they're uninsured because they choose to be uninsured or they oppose the ACA. In fact, what we find in surveys over and over again is that the uninsured do want coverage, but may not be aware that there is affordable coverage available to them. So with that, I'm going to wrap up, and our other panelists will talk about some of the other issues going on as people look to enroll in marketplace coverage.
Thanks, Rachel. We'll now turn to Cynthia, who's going to discuss how costs in the marketplaces are changing and choices as well as open enrollment begins and what's driving these changes.
Great. Thanks, Larry. So first I'm going to start with a little bit of a disclaimer, which is that there's a lot of attention that's paid to these so-called Obamacare markets, but there's also a lot of confusion about who's affected. So first I just want to clarify that the exchanges or marketplaces have a lot of names that they go by, like healthcare.gov, Cover California, which may be a little bit confusing to some people. But generally speaking, what happens in these markets does not affect most Americans. Only about 5% of the population gets their coverage through this market. So you can go to the next slide. About 12.7 million people are currently signed up through the marketplaces. Now, about 20 million people in total are buying their own insurance. Two-thirds, or 12.7 million people, are getting it through healthcare.gov or one of their state's exchanges. The rest of the people, about another third of those people, are buying it directly from an insurance company. The difference in coverage between these two groups of people is not very different. Really, the plans are more or less identical. The difference is that the people who are signing up on the exchange are eligible or potentially eligible to receive financial assistance. Now, HHS expects there to be about a million more people signed up in this market next year, or 13.8 million people. So it is expected that this market will continue to grow as it has in past years. We estimate that enrollment could potentially top out at about 16 million people. That's based on if all states performed like the top 10 at enrolling their potential markets. So really there's not a lot of room for growth in this market beyond what we've seen so far, what we're expecting, if all states kind of started performing like the top 10 do now. You can go to the next slide. So the exchanges are, and also the individual market overall, is kind of a temporary spot for a lot of people. There's a lot of churn in this market. So the people who are buying through the exchange are people who may be self-employed or between jobs. They may be too sick to work. They may be retired and don't yet qualify for Medicare. So there are a lot of people who come into the exchange market in 1 year and then leave, and then they're replaced by new people coming into that market. So as you can see in this slide, of the 8.8 million people who had effectuated coverage at the end of 2015, about 7.8 million re-enrolled, and then there were about 4.9 million people who were new to the market. You can go to the next slide. So as Rachel just discussed, there's been a historic drop in the number of people who are uninsured, and that's driven both by the expansion of Medicaid as well as the subsidies that are available in the exchange markets. And then when people get coverage, we find that they do use that coverage. They have better access to health care. But in fact, it seems that people may be using more health care in this market than insurers had initially expected. Next slide. So we've probably at this point, most of you have heard of insurers posting losses in this market. What are the reasons behind that? So in general, what we've seen is that the people who are signing up in this market are sicker on average than what insurers expected. Now, what that means is that there could have been fewer healthy people signing up than what was initially expected. It also may be that insurers priced their premiums too low. So there's competition in this market because of the way that the subsidies are structured to offer a low-cost plan. And in doing so, it seems that some insurers may have priced their premiums too low such that they lost money. And we estimate that insurers' premiums in this market, or the benchmark premiums that are used to calculate subsidies, are about 12% lower than what the Congressional Budget Office had projected they would be in 2016. Now, there are some other factors as well. There have been changes to what's called the Risk Corridors Program. This is a program within the Affordable Care Act that helps offset losses. So this does not necessarily cause losses for insurers, but it may have contributed to them having more losses than they otherwise would have. It also may be that some insurers had insufficient control over their costs. So in looking at the insurers that did well in this market, and some did, it seems that those insurers may have been more likely to offer narrow network plans, in other words, plans that had a limited choice of doctors and hospitals, and they may have been more likely to offer HMO plans, which have a gatekeeper so that people, have to get a referral to go to a more expensive specialist. So the plans that may have had more control over their costs may have also done better in this market. We can go to the next slide. So as I mentioned, we have identified a number of companies that are exiting this market. HHS also just released some data yesterday that suggests that there are more companies leaving the market than there are coming in. At the same time, there are more staying than there are leaving. So on average, we're expecting about 3.9 or roughly 4 insurers per state in the states that use healthcare.gov. And this is down from about 5 to 6 insurers per state in past years. The range is from 1 insurer in about 5 states to 15 insurers in Wisconsin. You can go to the next slide. So for the insurance companies that are staying in the market, many of them are faced with having to raise their premiums in order to cover their costs. As I mentioned before, a number of insurance companies appear to have priced too low to cover the cost in this market, so they are experiencing losses. Now, the other factor is that reinsurance, which is another risk program within the Affordable Care Act, is phasing out next year. And this program likely held down premiums by about 4 to 6 percentage points. So the loss of that program is also contributing towards premiums going up in 2017. There's also just the underlying cost of healthcare that goes up every year. And this is always a factor with premiums, but probably this year is less of a factor than some of the other considerations I just mentioned, especially having to adjust their premiums to adequately cover their costs. There are also some factors that may be driving premiums down. The health insurance tax was waived for 2017, which could have a downward effect on premiums. There's also a trend towards some plans offering more narrow network options. As I mentioned, these are plans that have a limited number of doctors or hospitals in their network. And this varies by market. Insurers have differing abilities to offer these sort of plans, but where they can, they may be able to offer a lower premium option that could be attractive for some consumers. And of course, there is still competition in most parts of the country, although there are a number of counties that will have one insurer next year, still we estimate that most people will have a choice of 3 or more insurers in the exchange markets next year. Next slide. So premiums are changing very differently across the country. As Larry mentioned, there really are 50 different Obamacares playing out across the country. So we have some states like Arizona that have experienced a tremendous loss in the number of insurance companies and tremendous premium increases. In Phoenix, Arizona, the benchmark silver premium is increasing by about 145%. At the same time, there are states like Rhode Island or Indiana and Ohio where premiums are actually decreasing in some parts of those states. On average, premiums are going up about 22% in this market nationally. So this is a faster increase than we've seen in past years. And for people who receive a tax credit, as long as they're willing to shop around and change plans, in some cases they may actually have to change plans, then they can save money potentially by enrolling in a low-cost option within their metal tier. As you can see in the orange bars here, if people shop around and switch to whatever the new benchmark premium is, they're receiving a tax credit, their premium increase could be essentially zero in most parts of the country. In some parts of the country, premiums were actually so low this year that a 40-year-old adult making $30,000 a year, which is the example shown here, may not have even qualified for a tax credit, so they may become newly eligible for a tax credit if their premiums go up. And Karen's going to go into more detail about this in a minute. So the next slide. So just to sum up, what we're expecting for next year is lower insurer participation. There will be more areas in the country that have just one exchange insurer. At the same time, most enrollees will still have a choice of multiple exchange insurers. We're also expecting higher premiums. Premiums are rising faster in most parts of the country than they have in past years. And there are many factors driving this growth, though a number of them could be temporary or one-time factors. As Larry mentioned, how consumers respond to these changes in premiums and insurer participation could determine whether this is a one-time market correction or whether this is a longer-term problem. If consumers drop out of the market, then that's a sign that probably the healthier people are leaving the market. So if we see enrollment numbers fall, then that could be a sign of challenges ahead for this market. If enrollment grows or holds steady, then that's a sign of stability. So looking beyond 2017, as I just discussed, really how consumers react to these changes in premiums and insurer participation will likely determine how this market looks beyond 2017. I would also kind of venture to guess that if insurers do enter back into this market, that they'll likely be, there will be more of a trend towards these narrow network plans or more HMOs, as we've seen so far. But ultimately, what needs to happen to attract insurers back to this market is for there to be growth in enrollment.
Thanks, Cynthia. Finally, we'll turn to Karen to discuss some of the logistics of open enrollment and how consumers have been experiencing the marketplace in the past and what they should be thinking about going forward.
Thanks, Larry. So I'm going to just walk through a number of steps pretty quickly here so we have time for questions. First of all, just a reminder to everyone that there is an obligation now under the ACA to have coverage. You have to report when you file your income tax return every year whether you had insurance, and if you didn't and you don't qualify for an exemption, you have to pay a tax penalty. That tax penalty has been fully phased in this year in 2016 and will be about the same next year. For people who need to buy coverage on your own because you don't get it at work, now is the time. Open enrollment is when you can sign up for private insurance that you buy on your own. Open enrollment begins next Tuesday, the 1st of November, and it runs through the end of January in 2017. That's when you can buy a health plan for 2017. After open enrollment closes, generally you will not be able to buy a private health insurance policy again until the following open enrollment unless you qualify for a special enrollment opportunity because you have a life change or lose other coverage. At the marketplace, you'll see qualified health plans. They all cover the essential health benefits. They're very similar, but they vary in the deductibles and other cost sharing that apply. You'll see plans organized by metal level. The bronze plans usually have the cheapest premiums but the highest deductibles, and at the other end, the gold and platinum plans have the lower premiums but the higher deductibles. Through the marketplace, as has been mentioned, you also, that's where you can apply for financial assistance to buy a policy and get help paying premiums this year. About 85% of people who bought coverage through the marketplace did qualify for premium subsidies. These are developed or delivered rather through tax credits that I will describe a little more in a minute. In addition, those tax credits can be applied to any plan in the marketplace other than special catastrophic plans. In addition, there is help to pay for the deductibles and other cost sharing under those plans, but that help is only delivered through special cost sharing reduction or CSR silver plans that are modified to reduce the deductibles and the copays lower than what would apply under regular silver plans. And finally, when you go to the marketplace, people with very low incomes will also find out when they apply whether they qualify for Medicaid, which is free assistance. And Medicaid enrollment is open throughout the year, not just during open enrollment. The application process is online. You can do this by yourself at home, or you can seek in-person help from a navigator or broker or another professional. You can find your marketplace website at healthcare.gov. That is the website for most states, and it will link to other state-run marketplace sites. And right on the homepage, you'll see a link to find local help, and that's where you can sign up for in-person help from an assister. Please don't wait until the last minute. As enrollment deadlines approach, it can be harder to get an appointment for in-person help or to get your questions answered. The application process is a two-part process. Assisters tell us it takes on average about 90 minutes to run through it if you're new to the marketplace. The first part is creating your marketplace account, entering your personal information, and applying for financial help. Then you'll receive an eligibility determination, and at that point you go to the second part where you review your plan choices and select one and enroll. The application will require a lot of information about you that's important, your name, your address, your social security number, your immigration documents, and an estimate of your income. So to prepare, you may want to gather documents so that you have that at hand when you're ready to apply. As you apply, keep in mind the marketplace will verify, as you're typing this in, it will verify your information in real time, pinging other trusted sources like the Social Security Administration, the IRS. If they can't match the information that you have entered in your application process, you may be required to submit additional documentation verifying your application information, and have to do that within 90 days. And then, again, once your eligibility for financial help is determined, you can move ahead to pick a health plan. The premium tax credits we've talked about, they are available for people whose income is between the poverty level and four times the poverty level. The formula compares your income to the cost of a benchmark plan. On a sliding scale, there's a requirement of how much you have to contribute to the cost of that benchmark plan. If you're at 150% of poverty, for example, that contribution works out to about $27 a month next year, and then your tax credit equals the cost of that plan minus your $27 contribution. That's like a gift card. You can spend it on anything that's available through the plan, and you can claim it at the end of the year on your tax return. It is a tax credit, but most people elect to have it paid in advance on a monthly basis to your insurer so that it reduces your premium each month. Importantly, when you apply for financial assistance during open enrollment starting next week, you'll be making an estimate of your 2017 income. And that's hard for some people to do, but you really have to do the best you can at this because at the end of the year, if you do qualify for a tax credit, you'll have to file your 2017 federal tax return in the spring of 2018, and at that point, you will have to reconcile the income estimate that you made during open enrollment with the actual income that you reported to the IRS, and then if you claim too much tax credit during the year, you might have to repay some of that. There is a form that has to be filed with your tax return, Form 8962. It'll walk you through the steps of that reconciliation process. Very important to do. If you don't, you may not be eligible for tax credits in future years. In addition to this tax reconciliation, though, the marketplace will also compare information on your application in real time, as I mentioned, to trusted sources. Most often for income, that's going to be your most recently filed return, which was your 2015 return. If the information about your income that you put on your application is more than $6,000 or 25% different from what you reported on your federal tax return, the marketplace might ask you to provide documentation on why you've experienced this big change in income. And again, it will tell you in real time if it needs this documentation. If you don't provide it, you'll temporarily get tax credits, but they could be taken away or reduced after 90 days. Once you have completed this application for financial assistance and received your determination, that's when you move forward to compare the marketplace plans. It's going to be very important to compare your total cost, not just the monthly premium, but also how much you're likely to pay out of pocket for the services that you use during the year that are subject to the deductibles and copays and other cost sharing. This can also be tricky for some consumers in many areas. As Cynthia mentioned, you may have a choice of dozens of health plans, and the cost-sharing features can vary quite a bit and sometimes in nuanced ways. This year, a new feature in the federal marketplace are some standardized plan designs. They are labeled new simple choice or simple choice plans. There's a little blue box next to them. So you can see those on healthcare.gov, and that will help you as you're looking across the simple choice plans, for example, in a metal tier. You'll still see differences in premiums, but you'll know that that does not relate to differences in cost sharing because all of those plans will be the same in that medical, in that metal level. Again, if your income is under 2.5 times the poverty level, that's about $30,000 for a single person next year. Be sure to look at these cost-sharing reduction silver plans. They'll cost the same as other silver plans, but their deductibles and copays will be much lower. Also, in comparing plans, you're going to want to look at the network type. There are closed plans, HMOs, EPOs don't let you get covered services out of network, but PPO and point-of-service plans generally will. Also, you'll want to check to see if your own doctors and providers that you use are in network, if the drugs you're taking are covered under the plan's list of covered drugs called the formulary. The marketplaces all offer plan compare and sort tools now with shortcuts that can help you identify plans that may be a better fit for you and that cover the drugs you take and the providers who you see. These are all kind of developing, and some are pretty good, but you will occasionally run into bugs still. So it's a good idea to look this up on your own, and just remember that all plans have to post a standard summary of benefits and coverage with information about each covered benefit, the cost sharing applies, and links to the provider network in the plan formulary so you can verify this information yourself. From our surveys of people who buy non-group coverage, most people tell us, after all that stuff, that shopping for plans was pretty easy, but about one in four tell us that they do encounter some difficulties setting up a plan or setting up an account or applying for subsidies, comparing plans. So, again, I would emphasize free in-person help is available from the marketplace, and you really should take advantage of that. In addition, our surveys tell us that most people who sign up for marketplace plans are satisfied with their coverage. The highest dissatisfaction that is expressed generally has to do with the cost of premiums and deductibles, and we've seen that dissatisfaction rising over the last couple of years. So, again, it's worthwhile to seek in-person help and make sure that you're getting all of the financial assistance that you are eligible for. For people who are returning to the marketplace to renew coverage, that's about 60% of participants who's here. Important to remember that you have to act to renew your coverage and your financial assistance every year. Open enrollment is when you'll do that for 2017. Open enrollment runs through January 31st, but all consumers are strongly advised, new and returning, to pick a plan and update their application for subsidies by December 15th. If you do that, it will all take effect for coverage starting on January 1. After that, you may be playing catch-up. If you don't act by December 15th, the marketplace has procedures in place to automatically renew your coverage and your subsidies, at least for most people. And if you are automatically renewed, you will still have, through the end of open enrollment, to go back and update your information and make your own plan choices. Returning consumers pay special attention to the notices that are starting to come in the mail. By now, you should have received a letter from the marketplace explaining open enrollment and the deadlines for signing up. If you're one of those people that can't have your subsidies automatically continued into 2017, for example, because you didn't file a 2015 return this year, this marketplace letter will advise you of that and tell you how to proceed. In addition, you should by now have received a letter from your current insurance company saying whether your current policy will be offered again in 2017, how it will change, if at all, and what the new costs will be. If your plan won't be continued and the issuer is offering other plans, it will explain what other plans it offers. And how you'll be automatically renewed into one of those if you don't pick a plan by December 15th. And then if you are auto-renewed, you'll get another auto-enrollment letter after December 15th verifying the plan that you've been auto-renewed in and reminding you, again, that you still have time to pick a new plan through the end of open enrollment. If you're one of the consumers whose insurance company is not going to be participating in the marketplace next year, you'll be getting some additional notices from the marketplace. In addition to the ones I just described, before Thanksgiving, you will get a letter from the marketplace explaining a new process. It's an auto reassignment process just for these consumers whose insurers are leaving the marketplace. Right now, the marketplace is comparing the plan you have today with what will be offered next year and trying to match you up to the most similar plan that will be offered next year. This letter that you receive around the third week in November will explain this process. In addition, you'll receive a letter from a new insurance company, the one that the marketplace intends to match you to, if you don't act by December 15th. And that'll explain what that plan covers, what it costs, and what you need to do to send in your first premium payment so that coverage takes effect. If you read these letters, if you don't like that plan, you have until December 15th to pick a new plan, so nothing is set in stone yet. And then if you haven't acted by December 16th, there'll be new mailings that go out to these consumers as well, explaining the auto reassignment process, reminding that you have the remainder of open enrollment, and also explaining just for these consumers whose issuers are leaving the marketplace that you actually qualify for a second way to enroll in 2017 coverage. You qualify for a special enrollment period in SEP. That's running mostly parallel with open enrollment, so it's going to be a little confusing. But there are some differences in the procedures and in the deadlines for signing up for coverage. Everyone is strongly encouraged to just go ahead and pick a plan before December 15th. If you don't and you get one of these notices, it will explain the new procedures and deadlines. And at that point, you really may want to sign up for some in-person assistance, from a professional. Just to close, key dates, open enrollment starts a week from today. Sign up by December 15th if you want to make sure your coverage and your subsidies are in place for January 1. After that, you have through the end of open enrollment, January 31st, to pick a plan that will take effect either in February or in March. And then finally in April, all of us will have to file our taxes indicating our 2016 coverage. And if you received tax credits this year, that's when you will reconcile the premium tax credits with the IRS. And I think that's it.
Thanks, Karen. That was a lot of information. We've got some questions in through the chat, and just a reminder, people can submit written questions in the chat window. We've got a couple questions about people buying insurance outside of the marketplaces and how these reports of big premium increases affect them. Cynthia, can you please explain how those off-marketplace plans fit in?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, there are roughly, let's say, 20 million people who are buying their own coverage. Estimates vary, plus or minus a million or so people. But let's say 20 million people are buying their own coverage. About two-thirds of those are buying through the marketplaces, so through healthcare.gov or through their state's exchange. And there are the other third of people who are buying their own insurance are buying directly from an insurance company off of the exchange. When you buy off of the exchange, you are buying insurance that is very similar, if not identical, to plans that you could buy on the marketplace. The difference is that you cannot qualify for financial assistance to help with your premium or your out-of-pocket payments. Now, of those people who are buying off of the exchange, a substantial portion, about 2.5 million people, are likely eligible for assistance if they would move on to the exchange. So as Rachel had mentioned, there's likely a lot of confusion out there, both among the people who are insured and aren't insured, about what kind of financial assistance they are eligible for. And so there's a substantial number of people who could be getting financial assistance if they moved on to the exchange. But for the remaining people, there is no financial assistance available for them because their incomes are too high such that they don't qualify for a tax credit. That means they make more than 400% of the poverty level. For those people, they would have to pay the full premium increase. They may be able to shop around to find a plan that has a lower premium, but in many cases, they also may be faced with a premium increase that is unaffordable for them. And the concern is that those people may leave the market if they're not able to afford to continue their coverage.
Thanks. And just to add, that these people who are buying these very similar plans off the marketplace are part of what's called the same risk pool as the marketplace plan. So the premium increases that have been reported this week for the marketplaces will largely apply to the off-marketplace plans as well. But as Cynthia said, there's no premium subsidies to cushion the impact. Another question about the open enrollment period, which is has been shorter this year and last year, and what the rationale is for a limited open enrollment period, and whether this is a sufficient amount of time for people to enroll. Karen, you want to address that?
Sure. The first open enrollment period was long. It was half of the year. So the expectation was that this would become a narrow window, that all coverage is going to move on, all non-group coverage is going to move on a calendar year schedule, and that that 2 months would be sufficient for people, or 3 months rather, would be sufficient for people to sign up for coverage. What we have seen in the first three open enrollments is a tendency for people to wait until the end. So we do see a surge leading up to December 15th and then a smaller surge leading up to December 31st. So I don't know that there isn't enough time. It's just that if you wait, if you wait until the deadlines, then you can find yourself in a queue.
And I would just add the experience, as Karen said, the experience has been a surge in enrollment. There's really two surges. One is around December 15th, which is when you have to sign up for coverage beginning January 1st, and then the very end of the open enrollment period. The experience last year was that the big surge was December 15th. So that's around the time when we would expect most people to be signing up. The question for Rachel about the two questions. One is about the characteristics of the people who are eligible for help but aren't getting it, as well as the characteristics of people who are in the coverage gap. In which states are most of these people? What is the breakdown by gender, by race and ethnicity?
Sure. So among those who are eligible for assistance in general, they are not surprisingly people who are lower income, because that is who the provisions of the ACA are targeted towards, particularly people who are eligible for Medicaid. Adults are below 138% of poverty. Children are potentially living in families below maybe 2 to 3 times the poverty level. Many of them are actually working or in a family with a worker, but they may be working part-time positions. They may be working for small firms that don't offer coverage and aren't required to offer coverage under the law. When we turn to the people who are falling into that coverage gap, we see a lot of the same characteristics in that they are, not surprisingly, low income. They all, by definition, are living below the poverty level. And actually, the majority of people who are in the coverage gap are also in a family with a worker, but just don't have access to coverage. One thing that we note in our analysis is that more than 9 in 10 of people who are in the coverage gap live in the South, and that is because the states that have opted not to expand Medicaid are largely concentrated in the South. In fact, more than a quarter of the population in the coverage gap is in the state of Texas, and that's obviously because Texas has a large population as well. So there is definitely some geographic disparities in eligibility for coverage going on.
Thanks, Rachel. We had a number of questions from people in Arizona, which is not surprising given what's going on in Arizona right now. One question was from a woman there who said that she'd been informed that insurance agents in that state will not get paid commissions for services and advising people on and helping people enroll for coverage. Karen, can you address, first of all, what's happening with commissions generally? And also how people can get help if an agent is not available.
Sure. So there have been some press reports that insurance companies are, for this coming year, either sharply reducing the commissions that they pay to agents and brokers, or in some cases not paying commissions for marketplace policies at all. I think some state regulators are taking a look at whether they are going to permit that practice or whether they will permit insurers to pay differential commissions for policies on versus off the marketplace. So that's something that I think regulators are still taking a look at. Regardless of whether a broker or agent is available, and a lot of people have up until now depended on these professionals to help them apply for coverage and pick plans. The marketplaces also provide for in-person assistance programs. They're called navigators in many states. Sometimes they're called enrollment partners, or they're different names in different states. But go to that Find Local Help button and enter your zip code, and you will see a list of programs that are available that can also provide you assistance with both parts of the process, not only completing your application for financial assistance and getting all your documentation squared away with the marketplace, but also comparing your plan choices and getting your questions answered about how those plan choices work.
Thanks. And Cynthia, we had another question about why premiums are increasing so much in Arizona, and more generally, why what are the causes of the variation across states, the tremendous variation?
So premiums started out varying quite a bit from state to state, and just sort of taking a look back, like going back to 2014 or even 2013 when insurers were first setting their premiums for the exchanges, they had very little information to work with in setting these premiums. This was the first year that the newly reformed market was going to be in place. For example, people with pre-existing conditions could purchase coverage without being barred from it. People also with pre-existing conditions could get coverage for those particular conditions, whereas they may have faced some sort of exclusion before. And in the old market, one of the main ways that insurers competed was by trying to avoid sick people. In the new market, they are having to, you know, abide by a number of new regulatory changes, and so that made it difficult for them to set their premiums. Some insurers guessed wrong. Some guessed too high, some guessed too low. In places like Arizona, it seems that they guessed too low. Arizona, Tennessee, Minnesota, and parts of Pennsylvania, these are states that have shown up on our list of having at least part of the state had some of the lowest premiums in the country. They were abnormally low in the first couple of years. Now premiums need to increase in order for insurers to cover their costs. Now there are other factors as well too. You know, in some states it may be that the people who signed up are exceptionally sick. That does not appear to be the case in Arizona. But, you know, there are a lot of different factors that play out in different states. Another factor is whether the state expanded Medicaid or not, or whether they allow transitional policies, which are policies that are not compliant with the Affordable Care Act, to remain in place. And so in some cases, state decisions may have also impacted premiums in the market. On average, states that expanded Medicaid and did not allow these grandmother plans to stay in effect had healthier markets, whereas states that did not expand Medicaid and allowed grandmother plans to continue had sicker markets on average.
I think this, Larry, as Cynthia said, I mean, it's important not to look at just these premium increases, but also the actual level of the premiums and how they vary across states and how they average out nationally. In response to another question that's come in, we estimate that in 2016, the average premium, the average benchmark premium in the marketplace is about 12% below what the Congressional Budget Office, who are the budget scorekeepers in Washington, estimated they would be in 2016. So in other words, the premiums for 2016 came in 12% below original expectations. That means the cost to the federal government is lower and the cost to consumers is lower than expected. With these premium increases in 2017, it's likely that premiums, average premiums next year will be right about what the Congressional Budget Office anticipated. So even with these big increases, the premiums are still on average roughly what was anticipated. Karen, we had a question about whether people can buy coverage outside of open enrollment if they go directly to a broker or an insurance company. If you could just briefly describe kind of who the open enrollment period applies to and who can buy coverage outside of that period.
So the open enrollment period is for all of us, regardless of whether you have coverage now or you're uninsured. This is when you can come in and buy coverage for 2017 if you're buying your own policy. After that, enrollment is only available if you qualify for a special enrollment opportunity. Those involve most often loss of other coverage. People, as Cynthia talked about, the churn in this marketplace, there are a lot of people who won't be looking to buy coverage now because they're working and they have a policy at work. But maybe they're going to retire early in the middle of next year, or they get laid off, they lose that coverage. That triggers a special enrollment opportunity when you then have a 60-day window to buy coverage. a lot of young adults may not, who are in college, may not want to buy now because they're covered under their student health plan or their parents' health plan. But later in June, when they graduate or when their birthday comes around, they turn 26, they will qualify for a special enrollment period because they've lost that other coverage. You also qualify for an SEP if you have a change in family status, if you get married, if you have a baby or adopt a baby, following a move, if that move triggers a loss of other coverage and for certain other reasons. Medicaid, as I mentioned, is open year-round, so you can always sign up for that if your income is low. And the last group, Native Americans, are the other group that can buy year-round. They are not restricted to open enrollment.
Great, thanks. So, Cynthia, we have a specific question about slide 19, which is the premium changes before and after tax credits. If you could, as we pull up slide 19, if you could kind of explain what that dynamic is. Why is there a 0% increase in most of these places after taking tax credits into account? And why in Chicago and Albuquerque is there actually an increase even after tax credits?
Sure. So the way that the subsidies work is it caps what people have to pay at a certain percentage of their income. The idea behind this is that if you make, say, $30,000 a year, there's only so much that you can afford to spend on health insurance. And any amount above that is paid for by taxpayers through the form of the tax credit. So as long as someone is enrolled in the benchmark silver plan, which is the second lowest cost silver plan available to them, then they just pay a set dollar amount every year. That's really just determined based on how much money they make and what their family size is. And from year to year, that plan may change. So it may be Aetna offering that plan 1 year and Blue Cross Blue Shield offering that plan the next year. As long as you're willing to enroll in whatever that plan is, then your premium payment stays constant. So this chart shows someone who signs up for the benchmark premium, the benchmark plan, and as long as they are willing to buy whatever that plan is, their premium payment does not change. In Albuquerque and in Chicago, for example, premiums there for the benchmark plan were exceptionally low last year. They were so low that a 40-year-old who makes $30,000 a year, so kind of an average enrollee, may not have qualified for a tax credit because their premium did not kick over that dollar amount. So it has to exceed whatever their set dollar amount is for the subsidy to kick in. So for those people, they were actually paying less last year than most other people would have been in their same circumstance. Now going into next year, the premiums are increasing such that they do cross over that threshold. So this is why basically when you look at percentage changes, it's not always kind of a clear picture. You also want to consider what the starting point and the ending point is. So although for this particular person in Albuquerque, New Mexico, it may appear that their premiums are increasing more than someone in Phoenix who's subsidized, the reality is that these people were paying less and now they'll pay the same as what someone in Phoenix pays, if that makes sense.
Hey, it makes sense to me. We also had a number of questions about sort of what consumers should be thinking about as they get notices of these bigger premium increases. What kind of message should be sent to get them to enroll? Karen, go through kind of what are the options for consumers when they see these big premium increases, whether they're buying on the marketplace or off the marketplace, and what are the considerations in terms of subsidies, plan choice, and the individual mandate.
If you have been in the marketplaces, the notices will try to at least estimate what your net premium will be, taking into account your tax credit. So that will give you a clue about what the actual impact on your wallet will be. But again, it's very important to go back and update your application so that you have the most accurate tax credit applied as you possibly can. For people who are off the marketplace, we talked about how some may be eligible for coverage but not realize it, and some others may be just above the level of eligibility. Maybe their income is 450% of the poverty level. You should, it's worthwhile to look on the marketplace and see if there's a similar plan to your current off-marketplace plan that's offered in the marketplace. In particular, for those people with incomes that are just above the level, if something should happen during the year, maybe you're self-employed and some of your business expenses unexpectedly go up so that your net income might actually drop just below the subsidy eligibility level, then you can still claim that tax credit at the end of the year as long as you're in a marketplace plan. So you're kind of keeping your options open for in the event that you might become eligible during the year, that your projected 2017 income estimate is a little bit off. So that's something that's worthwhile to know. If your premiums are going up beyond the level that you really feel like you can afford, there is at least an exemption for the mandate. If the lowest cost premium exceeds a little more than 8% of your household income for the year, you won't have to pay a penalty for being uninsured during the year. So that is the one bit of silver lining for folks who feel like they may not be able to afford the premium increases that they're facing if they're off the marketplace and not eligible for subsidies.
Thanks, Karen. I think that's probably a good place to leave it. As people start shopping on the marketplace, faced with in some cases their insurer exiting or big premium increases. There will be a substantial amount of upheaval, but also options for people. And looking at the larger policy issues, how this open enrollment goes will influence perceptions of how the Affordable Care Act is working and what might be a significant policy debate over potential fixes and improvements to the law next year. Thank you all. Thanks to our great panelists. Thanks, everyone, for participating, and as always, you can go to our website, kff.org, for more information than you can imagine on all of these issues.